Welcome back to Forbidden Knowledge News. I'm your host, Chris Matthew. Today, my guest is Jim Goodall. Before I bring him on, a couple of announcements. Coming March 11th, 12th, and 13th, we've got Forbidden Knowledge News Con. We're going to have 8 presenters. It's going to be online with a Rockfin premium membership, and you get the entire conference for only $10. Just sign up with that link in the description. You're going to get the conference. You get all our premium content, all the content from every creator on Rockfin, and all our previous conferences. New episodes are always available free on Rockfin, Odyssey, and all podcast platforms. Our website, ForbiddenKnowledge.news, is also the home of the Forbidden Knowledge Network. This is where we feature other podcasts from our wonderful community. Be sure to follow us on both our Facebook pages, Instagram, and Twitter. All those links are in the description. Guys, what does Big Pharma fear most? You being healthy and not being part of the perpetual cycle of being poisoned by Big Pharma and our medical industry. Break yourself free and check out what may be the most powerful antioxidant known to man. C60 Purple Power is amazing. The benefits have been personally outstanding, but do your own research. Click the link in the description and check out their website. If you order from that link, you get 10% off plus free shipping. What is your health worth to you? Today, I want to welcome back to the show Jim Goodall. He is a retired Air Force author and a world-renowned expert on the SR-71 Blackbird spy plane and the F-117 stealth fighter, as well as Area 51. He was also recently featured in the new documentary, Secret Space UFOs, Rise of the TR-3B. Jim, welcome back. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it. I enjoy doing this. I have, being that retired, I have a lot of free time.
So. Yeah, man. Well, it's really great to have you back on. It's been way too long, almost 2 years, I think. And
it's been that long?
I think almost. But wow. Yeah, we got a lot to talk about. You were featured in this new awesome documentary from our friend Darcy Weir, Secret Space UFOs, Rise of the TR-3B. Unfortunately, Darcy was unable to join us tonight. He had to leave town unexpectedly. But the show goes on. Tonight, we're going to be discussing a bit more about this new documentary. But first, because it's been so long since you've been on, I'd love it if you could remind the audience a bit about your background and what brought you to begin researching experimental craft and ultimately UFOs.
Well, I've had a love of machines forever, starting back when I was 5 years old, about 5 years old. We were living in San Jose, not that far from San Jose Municipal Airport. And it was still light out. I'd gone to bed and my dad came into the bedroom and he said, "I don't know what's coming, but you have to get up and see it." So we went outside and looked towards the Coast Mountains, and over the Coast Mountains came not one, not two, but 24 Convair B-36s. And that sort of burned into my brain, my love of airplanes and machines. A couple years later, the mid-50s, my best friend's dad was the commander at Moffett Field Naval Air Station when they had about 400 airplanes there. Now they have about 10. And his name was Danny. And the Marine guards and the shore patrol always referred to us as Captain Smith's son and that friend of his. And that sort of cracked me up. But I got over to Moffett and Danny said, "Hey, there's something really, really cool in the big hangar that you need to see." And those are familiar with Moffett Field, it's Hangar One. It's 400 feet high, 400 feet wide, and 1,100 feet long. It held blimps back in the day. So we ride our bicycles into the hangar and go to the far end, and there's an area that's roped off, black curtains, but no guard. And it said, "Keep out." But, you know, you're 10 and 11-year-old boys. We're not going to, maybe I think I was even younger than that. I said, "You're not going to keep boys out when there's something really interesting to see." So Danny and I went behind the curtains and he pulled the curtains back. And there is the prototype XF-104 Starfighter from the Skunk Works. At the time, it was still classified secret. And we're wandering all around there. Here's two little boys. I mean, and Danny said, why don't you get in the cockpit? And I wasn't quite sure, but it was that a double dog dare you type of thing. And I get in the cockpit, close the canopy. I'm in there about a minute, maybe two minutes. And all of a sudden, I started getting a little bit nervous. So I'm sitting on an ejection seat. I wasn't aware of the fact back then that they de-arm them when they put them inside wind tunnels. And I go to open the canopy and it jams. So we had to call shore patrol and a couple maintenance guys to get me out. And boy, did I get my butt chewed. So fast forward, 1962, I joined the Air Force. I'm stationed at various places, but I ended up at Lowry Air Force Base, just south of where you're at in Denver. And in February 1964, I had a set of temporary duty orders, TDY is what they call it. And I went, I had to go to Edwards Air Force Base for 90 days to support three programs in category one testing. I was a telemetry communications specialist. Now, mind you, I'm 18 years old. I was hardly even shaving. I was shaving for 2 years, cut myself both times. I mean, I was a baby faced kid. So I go to Edwards. I'm there. I get there middle of February. February 29th was a Saturday morning. And I'm listening to the radio's on. And all of a sudden I hear the fire alarm go off on the flight line. And this is big time. I mean, it's everybody who had a line badge was heading down there, and I had one, but our barracks were 8 miles from the flight line. So I didn't get a chance to see what all the excitement was. But on March, about 10 days later, I'm getting ready to fly off to Hawthorne, a suburb of LA. Northrop Corporation had a shuttle flight between Edwards Air Force Base and Hawthorne. It flew, I think, four times or five times a day. And it was a Piaggio. And I'm waiting for them to do whatever they're doing with the airplane, because the airplane is there. And I hear this roar. And I see all sorts of debris being blown across Rogers Dry Lake. So I went running down the taxiway, and I looked towards the XB-70 test pad. And there was what I thought was the X-15 at first, but people were too small, this big black thing. And about then, they yelled, hey, we're getting ready to load. So I jump in the airplane. And, there's only every seat's an aisle seat and every seat's a window seat. And I was blessed to be on the right side, the correct side of the airplane. We took off and we ended up going right over Rogers Draw Lake. And we banked over where this black thing was with fire coming out of it earlier. And I looked down, it had just shut off the engines. And they were towing a C-130 in front of it, so I could get a relative example of size, something I knew how big it was. And there it was. I'm looking straight down on the world had never seen it yet, and it was it wasn't the SR-71. It was the YF-12 interceptor, which was the interceptor version of the Blackbird, Mach 3 capable. Yeah, never went into operational service, but I was there the day it arrived at Edwards, and I saw it 10 days later, and I've never been the same. So I flew off to LA. It was Easter weekend. The big weekend. My grandmother lived in Laguna Beach, so I went out there, and when I came back, I had that Monday morning, I was given a set of orders. It was to go to the Lockheed hangar. So here I had seen the Blackbird, I was blown away. And then less than a week later, I'm walking into the back of a hangar and I'm looking at the rear end of two 2000 mile an hour black jets, the YF-12. And it's impacted me my entire life. So once I had 5 years active duty, I got out. 1968, I sent letters to Lockheed, Skunk Works, Air Force, Secretary of the Air Force, Secretary of Defense, and Chairman of the Joint Chiefs, asking for color 8x10s of the Blackbird in the air or whatever. I'll pay whatever the published rate is. And their official policy back then was not to cooperate. So because they wouldn't cooperate, I started digging. The more I dug, the more I found out. The more I found out, the deeper I dug. And to quote Ben Rich, who replaced Kelly Johnson at the Skunk Works, I am, from a historical point of view, the most knowledgeable person out there on the Blackbird program. I can ask questions that they couldn't ask back then when they were working in, you know, deep, dark secret. Because that's one thing you don't do. You're working on a classified program, and you may be in charge of a widget, and a left-hand widget. You don't know where it goes, but you have that. And your buddy could be working on the right-handed widget.
Yeah.
And you can't tell it. You can't go, hey, what are you working on? Because as soon as you start getting nosy, they're going to start watching you. And if they pull your clearance, you're without a job. They're not going to arrest you, but they're going to fire you, or they're going to make it so you cannot work in this particular industry ever again, working on, you know, classified programs. So, you know, just one thing led to another. And I because I started digging, I found out more. And because of what I dug up, I ran into guys that flew the Blackbird. I met John Lear, John Andrews, all sorts of other guys that love things that go bump in the night. And that's basically, and then I went back and then I decided I needed access to military bases. And the easiest way to do that is to join the Air Guard or the Air Force Reserve. So I ended up joining the Minnesota Air Guard. And I was the wing historian for 16 years. And I was on state staff as the state staff historian as well. But because of my friendship with Ben Rich, we talked once a quarter for 25 years. He liked the fact that I loved his products coming out of the Skunk Works. And we had a close mutual friend, John Andrews, who from Tester. He did the big quarter inch SR-71 model and the F-117, big F-117 model. He also did Bob Lazar's sports model. And because of John Andrews, I met John Lear. And through John Lear, I became friends with Bob Lazar. So that's basically the foundation of where I'm coming from. I have a habit of not playing inside the lines. I've had little red dots on my chest out in the desert, and I figure the paperwork is just too cumbersome for them to shoot me. So I feel fairly confident. Now, if I'm trying to break in and go over the fence or whatever, they can stun me and they can do whatever. But if I'm public lands, they know they can't touch me. And they know I'm not afraid of them. I mean, a good example.
Yeah.
When they moved the F-117s out of Tonopah test range, they moved down to Holloman, and then they went to Desert Shield and Desert Storm. And then when they said that Tonopah test range was going into caretaker status. This was 1990 and 91 timeframe. So fast forward to 1996, John Lear and I are at the fence line of Tonopah test range. It's about 11 o'clock at night. There's all sorts of activity down there on the flight line. So we know it's not in caretaker status. And we're out there with our lawn chairs, which is things you need when you go out in the desert. You tape your pant legs up so the scorpions can't go up your legs. And you use a lawn chair so you're not sitting on the ground. So we're sitting here, and we both have night vision goggles, and I see three armored personnel carriers coming towards us. We have one from the south, one the east, and the west. And there's also a vehicle coming down the public lands side of the fence. Now, the correct name for the public lands is BLM, but that has a real nasty taste in my mouth. So it's Bureau of Land Management.
Yeah.
Not Black Lives Matter.
Right.
Even though the airplanes are black. So I stand up and yell real loud, hey, we're good guys, we're taxpayers. And all of a sudden, both John Lear and I had red dots on our chest. We were floodlights from three Army personnel air carriers are on us. And there's a guy coming around John's pickup truck with his hand on his gun. He's in desert utilities. He said, "You're in a restricted area and I'm ordering you to leave." I said, "Sir, I don't know who you are, but this is public lands and I'll have to go in. I don't have to go anywhere." He said, "Yes, you do." And I pulled out the aeronautical map in my back pocket. He said, "According to this official government publication, the longitude and latitude of the restricted area is listed there. And if you go look at the fence post next to my friend, there's a USGS medallion that gives the longitude and latitude to the second. We're in public lands and I can be here for 15 consecutive days without asking anybody's permission." And with that, he was really, really getting pissed at me. He said, "I want to see some ID." I said, "Well, who are you?" "I'm Captain So-and-so with ASI, which stands for Advanced Security Inc., Contract Security." I said, "Well, sir, you're a rent-a-cop. You have no jurisdiction on this side of the fence." He got really, really pissed. He said, "I've been deputized by the state of Nevada, Esmeralda, Lincoln, and Nye County to uphold the laws of the state of Nevada and the federal government." I said, "Well, good for you." He said, "Well, I want to see some ID." I said, "Well, tell you what. Show me, you show me yours, I'll show you mine." So he handed me his ASI badge and I gave it back to him. I said, "Sir, I need a valid, this is not a valid form of ID. I need something issued by the state or federal government." And you can just see his jaws just tightening up. I mean, he is pissed. So he shows me his Nevada driver's license. I didn't have my glasses on, so I couldn't read what his name was. And I pulled out my Minnesota license because that's where I lived at the time. Lear pulled out his. And we hand it to the guy. He hands it to a guy on the south side of the fence. He goes up to the probably the supervisor in one of the Army personnel carriers, and he turns the light on. And I'm real hard of hearing. I only have about 20% of my hearing range in one ear and none in the other. And I hear him say, "Oh shit, it's good all in Lear." The lights went off. The red dots went away. And he said that the guy said, "Well, see you later." And he left. And John knew they weren't going to do anything that night because they knew we were there. But it's who I am. I've always been a pain in the ass to the federal government. I don't do anything that's going to end me in, put me in jail or get me prosecuted or get my car towed. But they're getting real brazen. I was just out there the end of August. And I had October. I was out there with a couple of friends of mine. They wanted to show me the back way, show me ways where we can maybe see something. So we went out in Tippecanoe Valley, and there's roads going up to a mine, which is up near the top of the Groom Range. And that's where the radar unit is in the very top, and it's Bald Mountain. And there are new signs out there. Look, it looks like the security people are trying to increase the perimeter around Area 51. Now, they cannot take public lands. They can only do that with the approval of Congress. And they've never, to my knowledge, approved any more land grab out there. But there's signs out there and there's sensors everywhere. So as soon as you drive out in an area, they know you're there. Also, if you stay at the Little Alien or if you stay at the Ash Springs Motel, those are the only two within 100 miles of Area 51. Then they probably know that we're there because they were on us almost instantly when we were out Tippecanoe Valley. But I took them to the north fence line, which they didn't react to. But we're in a white pickup, which is very four-door pickup, which is very similar to what security people use. And I think the added security is a result of the storm Area 51. I was there for that too, but I was there with CBS News and with George Knapp.
Yeah.
And there were more security people than there were people wanting to invade Area 51. But the word had come down from the Pentagon. Now, I don't know if it was the Secretary of the Air Force or Secretary of Defense or the Attorney General or whomever. He said, "No one will be allowed to penetrate the perimeter of Area 51, period." And they spelled out period. This is a buddy of mine is way up in the food chain at Nellis. He's a civilian. And he said, and they gathered all of the non-lethal crowd control equipment and put it on the the two areas that you could breach the area, and that would be the North Fence Line and the back road off of my mind just went blank. As you come out of Hancock, I mean, you come down into the Tippecanoe Valley, you'll see this road, 4-lane dirt road, and it heads into the foothills. And through those foothills, on the other side of that is Area 51. Yeah, and it's they're getting pretty ornery out there. But I'm again, as long as I'm not breaking the law, there's nothing they can do to me.
Yeah,
and I probably over the last 40 years, because I've been going out to Area 51 since the late 70s. So that's 45 years I've been going out there almost, and I make it a point not to do anything that's going to cause me to, much harm, and that whether it's financial or otherwise.
Yeah.
So,
well, I know. Go ahead.
Yeah, go on.
Well, I was just going to say, I love what you're doing, and, I appreciate all the work you've done and the research you've been putting into this. And I want to talk a bit about this new documentary. As far as the TR-3B goes, when did you first kind of get wind of this craft and then start looking into it?
I've been hearing, buzz. The name's been buzzing around for about 7 or 8 years that I'm aware of. I'm not a UFO guy per se. I know we're not alone. I'm a hardware guy, and that's why I go out in the desert. I want to see something. I want to photograph something that is a gee whiz type of airplane. Like when I was the first non-military, non-Lockheed person to photograph the F-117. And it was a surrealistic experience. I mean, it was like I was a 10-year-old boy seeing a naked woman for the first time. I mean, my whole body was vibrating when I was trying to take a picture of my very first F-117 shot. So it's just something I just love to do. And unfortunately, there aren't many of us. There were a number of us in the 90s. There was probably about 20 of us that went out into the desert on a regular basis to see what our government, it's for the people. We are the people. We are the taxpayers. It's our money that funds these things. So I feel it's my right to make sure that my money is being spent properly to go out and see what they're flying, see what they're doing. So, that's when I started hearing more and more about the TR-3B. I'm a longtime friend of Bob Lazar. I knew him before he went to work out in the desert. And he was working on the similar type of propulsion that Darcy is showing the world in his documentary on the TR-3B. And there's a number of videos in there that really just really, really exciting. The part that really got me is when there was it was contact in the desert, and I can't remember her name. I was talking to her last night online, but my mind's gone blank right now. But she had been with her cell phones. She had been looking at some lights that were sort of stationary, but moving around a little bit every once in a while. And it wasn't until she looked at what the camera in the phone had seen. Now she's looking up for the whole time, and she doesn't see the shape. But all of a sudden, you see these three lights, and a triangle is all of a sudden you can see the triangle, and it's just sitting up there. And the bright light that she had been focusing on is directly below it. And that's probably one of the better images of the TR-3B. And the premise that Darcy uses, and I don't disagree with him at all, that we do have a secret space program. And that's been going on since the early 70s. They had the Manned Orbital Laboratory, or the MOL. It was going to go up on a Titan II. It was a Gemini capsule associated with it, and it was they're up there basically a manned KH-11 spy satellite, and they can move it around. They could zoom in on various Soviet airfields and locations, and every astronaut that has been into deep space. I'm talking about the moon, the Apollo guys. Half of them have come out in recent years saying that they were being watched when they were on the moon. There were craft up there far superior to ours. There were entities, beings, little gray man, green man, whatever, you know. They didn't give any description other than that fact that they were being observed. And the question arises, we had built Saturn V rockets for Apollo 18, 19, and 20. And for whatever reason, those programs, those ended. They didn't, you know, they didn't launch anything. It ended at Apollo 17. And that's why there's three Saturn Vs on display, one at Huntsville, one at Houston, and one at Cape Canaveral. So why did we spend all this money to go to the moon and then out of the blue just quit going back? We haven't been back, what, in 40 years, 50 years? Why? Were we told not to come back? Was there something there that scared the bejesus out of the astronauts? Yeah, when they interviewed Story Musgrave, for example, when he was doing servicing on the Hubble Space Telescope. He was outside of the shuttle for 5 hours, and he'd do something and they'd have to wait as they went through the routine and tested it. And a reporter asked him, he said, were you bored? What were you looking at? And he said, well, I was watching literally the world go by. He said, serious. I mean, he was real serious. He said, and I was looking for UFOs. And that got, you know, they got the news person sort of chuckling like, oh, yeah, you're pulling my leg. I think he was dead serious.
I was going to ask, based on everything that you've learned, and if you had to theorize, what would be some of the capabilities that this craft, TR-3, would be capable of maneuvering?
Well, if it is... has the capabilities that, you know, we think it has, then it has the ability to take a large contingent of could be military, could be scientists, whatever, to the moon or to Mars. Are we doing it? I don't know. I know there's a lot of excitement now with Elon out there. He's going to be the first civilian to. He said he's going to. He wants to die of old age on Mars. So that's going to be interesting. And, you know, there's stuff that is happening out in space, and it's been happening for a long time, even before the Wright brothers. There's no explanation for it. You look at hieroglyphics and petroglyphs around the world, and you'll see, you know, craft in the sky, disc shape or something with a dome on it. And then the beams coming down, and you see humanoids, but with big heads and big eyes, and maybe a dot for a nose and a little slit for a mouth, which is a description of grays. And my friend Ben Rich, now I to qualify my friendship with Ben Rich, we spoke on the phone once a quarter for 25 years. If I didn't call him, he called me, and we just chat for a bit. But he loved. And I think he was intrigued by my fascination with all things skunkworks. And in 1993, shortly after he retired, he was a keynote speaker at UCLA. It was an aeronautical school's graduate program, and he was the keynote speaker. And at the very end of his session, he looked at the audience. He said, you know, we have the ability to take ET home. Now think about that question or that statement. We have the ability to take ET home. Now, the closest star is four light years away? And that's at 186,000 miles per second. How do we have the ability to take ET home? The same goes for when I was talking to him at UCLA. He was at USC Medical Center. He was dying of esophageal cancer. He more than likely was exposed to the nasty chemicals associated with the solvents used in low observable coatings. And we were talking about a lot of things, and I know he was near the end of his life. And we got to the subject of our mutual friend, the late John Andrews from Testers. And he said, "Jim, we have things out in the desert." And he wasn't referring to Area 51. He said, "We have things out in the desert that's 50 years beyond what you can comprehend. Not what you think you can build in 50 years, but what you can comprehend." And I can comprehend a hell of a lot. He said, "If you've seen movies like Star Trek or Star Wars, we've been there, done that, or decided it wasn't worth the effort." And I said, "Ben, you want to expand upon that?" And typical Ben, he said, "No." And he had the nerve to die on me about 10 days later. So I never did get to interview him, unrestricted.
Right.
So are there things out there? Yes. Have we been visited by other entities? I have to believe yes. Do I have proof? No. But I'm a very logical person. I think my thinking functions are fairly fine-tuned when it comes to aerospace and space-related stuff. We haven't been sitting still. And one of the things that sort of there's a number of events that told me that we have things out in space. And we're seeing triangles all over the world. Why? Is it ours? Are they ours? It could be. Are they extraterrestrial? Very well could be. It's just until one lands on the White House lawn during a live broadcast around the world, I don't think people are going to believe it. They have made UFOs, UAPs, which is a garbage word, flying saucers. For years, up until about 5 or 6 years ago, you said, "Well, I believe in UFOs," and people will snicker. Now they say, "Oh, really? What do you know?" I had when Tucker Carlson and another federal government employee states on the record that there are craft not made on this earth flying in our airspace. That's when I thought things were going to break loose. Unfortunately, now I called Bob Lazar shortly after, and I said, "Hey, what do you think of the announcement from Tucker and this other federal guy?" And he said, "Well, at first I was really excited, but then he said, I want to see something. I have to wait for the other shoe to drop before I make a comment." And of course, the other shoe hasn't dropped, and they only went back 5 or 6 years on the really poor quality Tic Tac stuff and whatever. And I know from people, in spooky programs, that hint to the fact that we have real high quality imagery of a number of different craft. But it's something that the people who say, you're nuts for believing in UFOs. How do you explain Machu Picchu? How do you explain, pyramids in Egypt and around the world, and the commonality between some of their drawings and hieroglyphics and petroglyphs? And for a couple of years, I was a docent at Kitt Peak National Observatories outside of Tucson. They are there's 50 optical telescopes, not 50. There are 22 optical telescopes on Kitt Peak. there are two radio telescopes, a 12 meter and a 25 meter. And the 2.1 meter telescope was used by Caltech for 5 years using adaptive optics and remote operation. And over the course of 8 years in a postage stamp size area of our Milky Way, our galaxy, they were able to and catalog 8,000 exoplanets just in that real small area of the Milky Way. And prior to me leaving Kitt Peak, I had to have knee replacement. And you're 7,000 feet and you're walking everywhere. You live in Colorado, so you're already at altitude. But being a lowlander, we're not used to it. And there was they called a meeting together of all of the astronomers, all of the technicians, and all the docents to come to a function at the, they call it NOAO, the National Optical Astronomy Observatories, and it's based at University of Arizona here in Tucson. And there was a scientist from the National Institute of Science. He had just returned from a worldwide conference on exoplanets. And said, based on proven mathematical formulas, and we're not looking at the crystal ball or fudging numbers. He said, based on all the information from all the astronomers that were gathering information on exoplanets, he said, they calculated for every star in the universe, there's 1.5 planets. Now you got to put that number in your head too. That's an incredibly huge number. And it said, out of that incredible number, there are 2 billion, and that's with a B, 2 billion Earth-like planets orbiting a similar-sized brown dwarf star as our sun in the inhabitable zone with liquid water. If we're the only ones, to quote Jodie Foster's character in Carl Sagan's Contact, if we're the only ones, what a waste of space. Mm. We're not alone. And we have never been alone.
Yeah, and I agree. There's so much going on, and this whole phenomenon is like a onion that would take lifetimes to unpeel. And there's so much to understand when it comes to it. But when it comes, I want to go back to the TR3B for a second. All the common either videos or descriptions that we get of this craft are the three lights, the one on each corner, and then there's one large one in the center. And I'm wondering, just based on all these descriptions and videos, what do you think the propulsion system is? Do you think it's running off anti-gravity? What do you think is going on with this thing?
Well, it's an anti-gravity engine in the center. And according to information that both Darcy has and I haven't seen hard evidence, but technical writings, that it is, they're using probably triple distilled mercury, maybe mixed with some other elements at right around 400 degrees below zero. I think it's 58 degrees Kelvin or 54 degrees Kelvin. Zero Kelvin is absolute zero when all atomic energy ceases to move. And we've gotten close to that, but we haven't gotten down that far. But it's been proven in other areas that you bring something down to near absolute zero, all of a sudden the properties and everything else changes dramatically. And it is believed that they're spinning this specialized mercury cooled down to minus 400 degrees Fahrenheit. And the spinning of this material creates an anti-gravity effect. In other words, it's pushing you away from things that are gravity. But according to people who supposedly have inside knowledge, that it's not 100% gravity free. It's about 80 to 90%. And the lights on the tips of the triangle are for propulsion. And so either go, you can go backwards, you can go forward, sideways, or whatever. But they're really, those are the propulsion units that make the aircraft travel And the other thing is, people have seen it. They've seen the lights, and then all of a sudden, the craft will sort of appear, but you can see stars through it. Our government has been working on active camouflage since the 50s. And in today's world, with the thin film capabilities we have, the flexible video screens, a good example, Samsung just came out with a folding smartphone. And I don't know how many bends you can make on it until it finally gives up. But it's, you know, it's 4G or 5G capable, or not 5G, 4K or 5K quality images. So they have, you know, there's been talked about, even back in the 60s, they were talking about putting some type of sensors on the top and the bottom of aircraft that would change the overall color to blend with the topography either above or below. So if you're flying, you know, through the clouds, you're going to see the clouds on the bottom of the airplane. It's going to look transparent. And that's, you know, that was sort of a pipe dream back in the 60s. But in the year 2022, if you see it in a if you see that type of technology in a commercial product, and Samsung is a prime example, that's 20 or 30 year old technology. Mm-hmm. Nothing that we see as consumers, when we say, oh boy, this newest iPhone is absolutely incredible, and this camera is absolutely unbelievable, and this and that and whatever. It's not new. It's, you know, the governments of the world, ours primarily, have been digging into that type of technology forever.
Well, that being said, how much of the footage, such as the Tic Tac and a lot of the other mainstream UFO footage that we've seen over the past couple of years, do you think a good portion of that is our technology?
I would have to say yes, but all we have to do is have one that's not. To prove that we are being visited. I mean, Richard Nixon invited, I hate it when my mind goes blank. The honeymooners, Jackie Gleason.
Yeah.
Took him to Homestead Air Force Base and showed him a craft that was there. There've been way too many people have seen UFOs or things they can't explain. You know, in early 1947, we were still using electromechanical relays, vacuum tube technology, hardwired. You know, everything was, you know, was hardwired. There weren't things called circuit boards, really, to speak of. And shortly after Roswell, all of a sudden, we were looking at integrated circuits. We were looking at software to function and operate things. We learned how to etch lines and things into silico substrate, you know, to give us transistors, to give us integrated circuits. It was rumored that it took DuPont 15 years to reverse engineer Kevlar. Kevlar has no, when you look at the chemical properties of Kevlar, you just have to shake your head, because there's no logical way using proven scientific and, you know, chemical engineering and manufacturing type of techniques. There's no pathway using it as the way our brains work and as how, you know, how the stuff was finally configured. But Kevlar has incredible properties. I mean, when I go out in the desert a lot, depending where I'm at, if I'm in the rocky areas, I wear Kevlar chaps. This way, if I come up next to the little things that rattles on them and he bites me, and you get bit by a Mojave Green and you're out in the desert near Area 51 and you're 150 miles from Las Vegas, you're dead. They're aggressive and they're nasty. The only snakes I've ever seen up there are timber rattlers, and they just want to be left alone. But it's the technology that's being incorporated, being used in the TR-3B, is probably along the same lines that Bob Lazar worked on and was helping to reverse engineer at S4.
Do you think a part of the reason that we're seeing a lot of kind of UFO information in the mainstream and from our own government is because they want to roll out some of these new toys to the public, or at least roll them out to where that the public has to know about them? What do you think?
No, I think that being responsible or in charge or being the person that has the say on something that's classified, something that's really far out, that's a real powerful position. And people who control security, they'll control regardless if it's good for national security or bad for national security. They try to keep those things closer to their chest. I mean, it's power. When you have the power over information, and that's what the tech companies are trying to control the way we think, the way we respond. Mm-hmm. And that's a bunch of crap as far as I'm concerned. But people who control your security are very, very powerful people. And also the thought of, I know something you don't, and you'll never get to know what's there, but I have it up here. And I can talk to it with my friends who also worked out there or whatever, but you'll never know what it is. And that's really sort of a power hungry type of response to why aren't they releasing anything on UFOs? Right. I think the other reason why they're not releasing anything is that we may not be in charge of the dissemination of the information. There may be a sword hanging over the head of the people who could release the information, but won't. And one of the big fears, and we were discussing it last night with a couple of people, and the fact that the glue that holds the majority of the world together, not necessarily first world, you and I, England, good part of Japan, you know, English-speaking countries, and a good part of Western Europe, is because of a firm believer in a supreme being. Mm-hmm. And if all of a sudden that supreme being, whether it's God, whether it's Jesus Christ, Muhammad, Buddha, you name it, you know, the 7-Eleven down in the corner that lights up green at night when everything's closed. it's those people who have a strong, strong belief in a supreme being, but it's the third world and the fourth world, and it's the glue that keeps civilized people, because I don't want to go to hell, from killing their neighbor. I mean, I know there's people out there that would have committed murder, and save for the fact that they didn't want to go to hell. Now I believe in God and I believe in heaven and hell, so it's not going to affect me. And I would be thrilled if I've been out in Tippecanoe Valley at night, the sun is just going down, there's no moon. And I'm saying, okay, I've been told that you can read minds. So I'm sitting there and I'm concentrating with all my might to say, okay, abduct me. I'm right here. Let me bring my camera with me. Yeah. Keep me as long as you need. I'll tell you anything you need to know, but abduct me. And people say, well, you don't want to be abducted. I said, yeah, I do. I mean, I want to be able to, I think I can speak intelligently on the subject, but I would like to be able to discuss it as an insider versus just an observer.
Right.
So and every night when I'm outside, now I live north of Tucson, our area, our neighborhood, which is in Oro Valley, we have no street lights except for the one main thoroughfare, Rancho Vistoso. Everything else, there's no street lights. So you go out in the backyard, it is dark. You can see the Milky Way. Most places you can't see it because of light pollution. But Tucson is working towards a dark sky initiative to reduce light being shown outside of the area you want to illuminate. In other words, pointing out to the sky and everything else, it makes things difficult for the astronomers. You know, you have light pollution, you can't see the faintest stars. That's why they're building massive telescopes in the middle of nowhere at 16,000 feet in Chile. They're putting together the giant Magellan telescope. It's gonna use seven 27-foot diameter primary mirrors, all focusing on their secondary mirror. And they figure once they get first light, and it could be this year they get first light. They've been building it for about 12 years, 10 or 12 years. They're saying that they may be able to look back to within 100,000 years of first light. And that's the beginning of the universe. And they also may see that there are parallel universes out there that we're not aware of. So there's a lot of exciting things happening in space. And the other reason I think more and more stuff is coming out on TR-3Bs and UFOs in general is everybody has this incredible thing about the size of a small tablet, maybe a quarter inch thick, sits in their back pocket, and it has an incredible camera in it. So if people are seeing this, they're zipping out their iPhones or their smartphones, and they're taking images. And some of them, in some cases, like the one of the TR-3B, actually decloaking. You couldn't see it, and all of a sudden you could see it, but you could still see the stars through it, but you could see the edges of the triangle. So they're out there, and I think it's just a matter of time. And it's my gut feeling. It's not based on anything I've heard or know, but I have a feeling that that disclosure is on its way.
Well, you know, I think that it definitely is, but I think it's gonna come from people like yourself and people in the community that have had the experience, and I definitely don't think it's going to come from our own government, but you never know what could happen. We're living in, like you said, very interesting times, so, yes. You know, I don't doubt whatever happens, you know, especially the weird stuff. But to close out, I know you knew Bob Lazar, and lately there's been a lot of controversy as to whether people, you know, arguing whether he was legitimate or not, whether he was really involved with some of these projects. So based on your relationship, what do you think?
Well, now, the way I met Bob Lazar, I was with John Lear. We're in Las Vegas, and we were just going to take a ride around the Nevada test site. You know, they had announced the existence of the F-117 in November 88. This is really early. It's like the first week of 89. And John and I are heading up US 95 going from Las Vegas to Tonopah. And about two-thirds of the way up there is Scotty's Junction. And Scotty's Junction is famous for the fact that it had a legal house of ill repute, a whorehouse for those who live in Rio Vista. And we were, you know, we were about 10 miles north of Scotty's Junction, and an F-117 flew across the highway at about a 45 degree angle at about 1500 feet. I about crashed the car. I mean, I saw this thing, I slammed the brakes, pulled over to the side, tried to jump out and grab my camera, but by then it was gone. So we hit Tonopah, we grabbed a real quick bite. We hit, drove up to US 6, which is the east-west road from the west coast to the east. We jump on US 6, we head out of town about 14 miles. The big sign down there at the bottom of the valley, Tonopah Test Range. And we drive down there, and 18 miles to the gate, we drive along the fence, and we're waiting for an F-117. And I look to the north, there's a big black dot with a little white light in the bottom and a white dot with a little white light. And I knew that had to be an F-117 with probably a T-38 chase, and it was. And this is before digital cameras. I had a Nikon with a really good telephoto lens, and I was shooting color print film. I was shooting Kodacolor 2, or Kodacolor 100, not 2. And 36 exposures. And this thing's coming into view, and it's filling up the viewfinder. And I'm like a 10-year-old kid seeing a naked woman for the first time. My whole body is just vibrating. So I didn't know if I had any decent shots. And back in the late 80s, early 90s, actually in this, from the 70s on, there were things out in parking lots that weren't selling coffee, but they were photo mats. That's where you brought your print film in. You drop it off. You don't even have to get out of your car. You drop it off. They process it. You come back the next day or the day after, and there you have your processed film and print of whatever you shot. And I knew by the time we got back to Vegas that the photo mats would be closed. So I had to wait till the next day. And I knew it was going to take, it was going to be 2 or 3 days. And I was just beside myself. I didn't want to bring the unexposed film back to Minnesota and process it there. So we left Tonopah. We stopped for a quick bite at the Little Italy Inn. And I went there the first time in 87. And then we made it back to Las Vegas a little bit after 9 p.m. We get to John's house. And they said, oh, by the way, I have a friend coming over in just a little bit. I think you'll like him. He just moved here from Albuquerque. He's a nuclear physicist. Okay, fine. And about 10 minutes later, there's a knock at the door. In comes, John goes and answers the door. John and this young man come walking in, and he introduces himself as Bob Lazar. He worked at Sandia. I think it was Sandia, he worked on Albuquerque, on nuclear weapons. So I told him about my dilemma about the film processing. And he said, hey, I have a C-41 processing unit at home, and I live over in West Charleston. Let's head over there. We'll develop your film, and we'll print some good ones. I said, let's go. So we did. So we're about a block from John's house, and he looks at me and he says, I feel sorry for that dumb son of a bitch Lear. I said, what do you mean? I said, the effing idiot believes in UFOs. How stupid is that? I said, I'm a nuclear physicist. If I can't prove it mathematically or put my hands on it, it doesn't exist. And you could put a gun to my head and you couldn't convince me that UFOs were real. That's before he got his job at S4. His story has not changed. He told me here a couple of years ago, the biggest mistake he ever made in his life is going public. He said it's been a millstone around his neck. Every time he turns around, said, you're a plant, or you're lying. Or this. He said it's not worth the crap he has to put up with. And that's why he didn't give any interviews or do anything for about 25 years. And George Knapp convinced him to do something with Jeremy Corbell. And I'm not a fan of Jeremy's. That's all. I'll just leave it at that. I've known George for 40 years. I think the world of him. Mm-hmm. But I'm gonna be up in Las Vegas in April with a whole group of you guys. Dave Scott's one of them. The UFO Garage guys are going to be there, and I think Darcy Ware is going to be there, and a bunch of other people. And we're just going to gather just ourselves. We're going to be at the Gold Nugget, and we're going to have a Q&A for the general public. And I'm not putting this on. I'm just a participant. But then I'm going to take a whole group of them up to and take them to, if we can get to the fence line of Area 51 in Tonopah. So that's what we're going to do. It's the 22nd, 23rd, and 24th of April. And I'm going to go visit John Lear. I saw him a couple months ago. His marriage to his to Mira Lee ended after 50 years. I don't know what happened. People change. So he doesn't live in his big house anymore. He has a house off of West Charleston.
Yeah,
not that far from Lazar's old house. And we're going to bring a group of people over to give him a visit. I think he'll really enjoy that because he's not mobile at all.
Yeah.
He's, when he was a young man, I'm talking in his teen years and early 20s, he crashed 3 airplanes.
Oh, wow.
And it destroyed his feet, literally destroyed his feet. Wow. And you had the video on, I don't know if anybody else will see it, but this is the rudder pedal. When he hit the ground, his feet folded, his toes hit his heel. That's how bad his feet were broken.
Yeah.
So he's not mobile. He did go to a function here last year. Some friends picked him up. You know, they have a van. They can, you know, he can get in there and, you know, get his scooter and everything loaded up.
Yeah.
But he's just, if you have not had the joy and the interesting afternoon or evening to spend with John Lear, you're really missing something.
Yeah, I mean, he's been on the show a couple of years ago, and I'd love to have him back on. He was a great episode.
And he flew for Continental Air Service, which was a subsidiary of Air America. And for years, he had to take them off because they caused arthritis. He had a 24-karat gold, not an 18-karat, a 24-karat gold Rolex, and the watch strap, if you want to call it that, mm-hmm. was linked 24-karat gold. And he had, on his other hand, he had a 24-karat gold ID bracelet. And between the two of them, it was a kilo of gold. Oh, wow. He said, gold is good tender. So if he got lost somewhere, had to crash his airplanes in the jungles of Cambodia or Laos or wherever, he had his get out of jail free card on his, with both his watch and his ID bracelet.
Right on.
And he's done some increasing. He still holds 16 FAI world records. Mm-hmm. He flew around the world on his 16th birthday in his dad's Learjet. And Bill Lear had friends in high places in the Soviet Union, in the Middle East, and of course in China. So he was able to cut across a good swath of area that we can't, you know, that we can't fly today on a similar route.
Yeah.
But he holds 16 world records for flying solo. He had a FAI observer on board, but he couldn't do anything. All he can do is watch. And he holds the record for around the world flight.
Yeah.
And he was on his 16th birthday. So he is a national treasure, only because because of his family background, but he's also one because of what he's done in his life. And I'm not sure which daughter has, they're doing a movie or a documentary on John.
Oh,
and I know it's been working on it for a while. I don't think George Knapp has anything to do with it. And I know Jeremy doesn't, but you know, Mary Lee, up until their marriage came to an end, that's his wife, was responsible for all the non-star people on any movie that was filmed in Southern Nevada, in primary Clark County. She would do all the site work and supplied all the non-artists. I mean, the backup people, the stand-ins, the catering, and everything else.
Yeah.
So his daughters have that background to draw from, and the name Lear is still a very well-known name.
Oh yeah, for sure. Yeah, the man's definitely a legend. And Jim, thank you so much for coming on tonight. This was fantastic information. If people want to see Secret Space UFOs, Rise of the TR-3B, what's the best way that they can do so?
Go to Darcy's website. If you put it on, I don't have it in front of me. I just click on it.
I think it's occultjourneys.com, I believe.
Yes, that's it. Yeah.
Yeah.
And, like it. And if you, share it with anybody you think would find it interesting.
Yes.
Now, can I talk about my latest project?
Of course. Sure. Yeah.
Okay.
Please do.
It's not the latest one. It's the one that's been out the newest. Mm-hmm. I just finished a 384-page hardbound book called 75 Years of the Lockheed Skunk Works.
Oh, wow.
I cover 43 different programs, and there's in the neighborhood of 1,100 photos, of which over half of them have never been in print. And I even had... I'm not sure if it was Sher Mullen or Jack Gordon, one of the former presidents of the Skunk Works, got the book and he said, "I don't know, you got some stuff in there I wasn't aware of."
That's great. Yeah.
So I had a book signing at the Skunk Works June 3rd last year. And I spent 2.5 hours with the vice president, general manager of the Skunk Works, Jeff Babion. And they bought a whole slew of my books, given out to, you know, people who worked there, you know, in the headquarters of the Skunk Works there at Palmdale. But one of the things we did, and we were heading over to the U2 operation, we were being driven over there, and I'm in the back seat of the car with Jeff. And I looked him right in the eyes. Okay, Jeff, what is the Skunk Works involvement using alien technology in some of our new programs? I think he's sort of taken back a little bit because I had the balls to ask him that. And he said, I'm telling you, this is the god awful truth. I mean, he's looking me right in the eye. If someone's lying to you, they're not going to look you straight in the eye. And he said, I have absolutely no knowledge of any product or any system within the Skunk Works that uses alien technology not made of this earth. But he said, that doesn't mean it didn't happen before I got here.
Yeah.
And it may be so compartmentalized and so deeply buried that I have no need to know what happened in the past. My job is to prepare Lockheed for the future. He said, but personally, I can't imagine that we're the only ones. The universe is too big. He said, but I'm not speaking on behalf of Lockheed as it pertains to, are we alone? So we're not alone.
Yeah.
I mean, and I think you can put money on that. And it's only a matter of time before there's an incident that we can't cover up. A crash, an accident, a mid-air collision, something along the lines. I mean, and they've been coming here since time began.
Yes, that would definitely be incredible. Jim, thank you so much for coming back on again. And I'd love to speak with you again about your new book in the future.
Anytime. And my 29th book, which I just got an email from my publisher today. I forgot to send him something. It's on the nuclear navy. Now, my area of interest are low observables, stealth. And someone said, well, what are you doing with submarines? I mean, I have a book, a hardbound book on the Los Angeles class and their adversaries. I have my volume 2 is on the Seawolf and Virginia class. And these are full color books, 160 to 180 pages. And I'm working on my Ohio class. He said, well, why submarines? I said, they're black, they're stealth, and they're deadly. And they're almost always underwater, and you don't know what the hell's inside. You see a black tube, and that's all you see. And sometimes all you see is the they call it the fair weather or the sail. But I photographed in detail everything from the reactor room bulkhead forward. The communications area, the sonar, the torpedoes, the missile launch area of the Ohio boats. And I decided, well, there's nothing out there that covers all of them. So the United States Navy over the since 1956 has built and paid to have that are currently in construction 227 nuclear powered submarines. And I cover them all. There's at least one full page of the subs. I have at least two or three shots of every single submarine. I have the interiors. I have all sorts of stuff. And it's people, guys I know in the submarine service said, oh my God, said there's been something like that needed forever. I mean, I even had a Navy captain tell me the same thing at their Point Loma sub base. So that's my newest product.
It's
320 pages, and it should be out at least for Christmas.
Awesome. Well, everybody, please go look for that. Get Jim's other books. Check out Secret Space UFOs, Rise of the TR-3B, and Jim will talk again soon for sure. And until next time, everyone, have an excellent evening, and we'll talk again tomorrow.